Good afternoon. Please continue to enjoy lunch. I'm Jeff Clark, a partner here in the D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis, your host for today. Apologies that I'm your emergency fill-in moderator. I note that I've often labored in vineyards other than class action or other mass tort litigation in the past throughout the course of my career, but I've also spent the past seven years working on MDL 2179, which arose out of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, so hopefully I'm equipped to help steer the conversation here in some good directions. And you are here for the trying cases and settlement panel in the MDL space, and your panels here are illustrious practitioners. I'll be introducing them in the order in which they'll be speaking. First, we have John Beissner, partner at Skadden and the leader of its mass torts, insurance, and consumer litigation group. He's worked on an astounding over 600 putative class actions. Then we have Chris Seeger, who was on the last panel as well, who is founding partner of Seeger Weiss. Mr. Seeger earned leadership appointments from state and federal courts throughout the United States in many of the country's most complex and noteworthy MDLs, including in the NFL concussion injury MDL. Third, Brian Jackson will speak. Mr. Jackson is a partner at Butler Snow. Mr. Jackson is the assistant practice group leader there of his firm's pharmaceutical, medical device, and healthcare group. He has more than 20 years of experience as a trial lawyer, and he has had key responsibilities in jury trials of complex cases. Last but not least, we'll hear from Jonathan Selbin of Lees Cabraser, one of the firms that I've worked opposite to in MDL 2179. Mr. Selbin is the chair of Lees Cabraser's Economic Injury Product Defect Practice Group. And most recently, Mr. Selbin received the 2016 Distinguished Service Award from the American Association for Justice. So with those introductions out of the way, I'll turn it over to John. And each of our panelists is going to speak for a few minutes, and then they're going to go dynamic and start hashing things up with each other. And at the end, hopefully, we'll get some time for questions.
And I guess that means when we speak individually, we don't have to be dynamic. So that's fabulous.
You can just be as static as possible, John.
Okay,
go for
great.
It.
Great, thank you. I think my task was to talk a little bit at the outset about bellwether trials. And I think, as Judge Rubino noted earlier, you can, within the judicial system, say, my God, trials have just disappeared. But if you looked at MDL proceedings and you want to do trials, that's the place to be, because they definitely are happening there. You know, I think that the reason they're more commonplace in MDL proceedings is frankly because of defendants' positions on these issues 25 or 30 years ago. You'd go to your first, and I'm speaking now about mass tort MDL proceedings, you'd go to your first meeting with the judge, and Chris, or whoever's playing Chris's role, would stand up and make this persuasive argument. The judge, you know, if we try all of these cases, you will be 435 years old at that point. And so, my God, we really have to get into settlement. And there'd be this argument that the judge immediately needs to appoint a settlement judge. And so all we should be doing is discovery and having settlement discussions. And those of us as defense counsel would stand up and go, hamana, hamana, hamana. And I think as instead of having nothing to say, we said, Judge, maybe we ought to find out something about this case and push the idea of bellwether trials as a way to learn more about the case. I'm not suggesting that we didn't believe that you would learn more about the case, but I think part of the impetus for that was to sort of stave off this idea that we have nothing to do here but settle the case. And I do think that bellwether trials, as Chris and others on the earlier panel mentioned earlier, in a lot of cases have been extremely useful. I think the usefulness has been somewhat more at the extremes, where you get a more consistent chain of defense or plaintiff victories, or you get different results in what are clearly different kinds of cases so that you can figure out what may be more worthy of settlement than others. So I think they have served a useful purpose. I think the concern, though, is that over time they've become just sort of a standard part of the playbook for both counsel and for judges presiding over these proceedings. It's just sort of, let's have a bellwether, series of bellwether trials, and how do we go about doing that? When I think, in fact, the usefulness of these exercises vary depending on the facts and the circumstances of the particular MDL proceeding and the type of case that it is. And I think from a defense perspective, you really have to stop and say, you know, is this the right thing to do in this particular case? And I suspect that the same analysis is true for plaintiffs. Just a couple things I'd note, though. I do think that the use of bellwether trials has gotten off course in some, but not all, MDL proceedings, and in primarily two respects. First of all, I think that in some instances, they become the totality of the purpose of the MDL proceeding, in part because of what Judge Rubino talked about earlier. When you start talking about, let's do a trial, it sort of takes over the proceeding, and everything leads up to that first trial or that series of trials. Everyone becomes preoccupied with that. And if you're in a case where there are some threshold issues, preemption, Daubert, other issues like that that ought to be resolved, those can sometimes get shunted aside because of the attention to that trial. I've also been in cases where I get the sense that the court's interest in dealing with those issues sort of subsides because of the feeling that learning something from the trial would be more productive than actually dealing with those threshold motions. Put another way, if those motions get granted, we ain't going to have a trial, and wouldn't that be a shame? I mean, I think that's sort of the concern. I think that there's also a problem that in some MDL proceedings, and I want to be very clear, this is not all, but we have seen in some MDL proceedings where I fear that the bellwether trial process becomes somewhat of a cudgel that the court uses to encourage settlement. And I don't mean, oh, let's get to trial, that sort of thing that you experience in every case, but it's, let's try to make the trial more difficult for a defendant. Let's put six plaintiffs up for trial, which is, I think, by most measures, very difficult. Or let's let plaintiffs choose all the cases that we're going to try. The selection process becomes somewhat skewed. And I suspect that in any given case, plaintiffs would say, well, no, you're giving a one-sided view of that. But I think it does get used as somewhat of a cudgel in that regard. The one additional point I would make about that, though, is that I think as defense counsel, there needs to be a clear understanding that this should be within the control of the parties. You know, 1407 does not give a trial court, an MDL court, the authority to try one of these cases. Indeed, quite to the contrary, as was discussed in the earlier panel, it's for pretrial proceedings only. And there needs to be a waiver of lexicon. And of course, as the BMS decision is instructive on, if the plaintiff in the case is not from the district in which the MDL court sits, the court, from a personal jurisdiction standpoint, may not have authority to try the case. And so I think that, you know, counsel on both sides need to realize they have some control over this process. I think what happens in a lot of cases is court charges in, we're going to have bellwether cases, and sort of takes over the process. But at the end of the day, I think that, that really is something that's in the control of the parties. It was interesting to me that when Fakala was pending on the Hill and before the House voted on it, the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts sent a letter that basically said, why do you need this provision in the bill that says that an MDL court may not try a case without the specific consent to that particular trial of all parties to that particular case? That's the law now. And I think a lot of us as practitioners said, well, that's interesting to hear that from the administrative office, because that's certainly not the way a lot of MDL judges have approached the issue. We recently, in our office, had a case before the Fifth Circuit where this issue was up, and the court, ruled that, you know, that does have to be a case-specific waiver. And it was interesting. There was a conference at which Chris and I were present, and I'm sure some of the others of you at Emory a couple of months ago, during which several of the MDL judges took note of that decision. And one of them said, you know, we probably now need in MDL proceedings, before we start a trial, the written consent of the parties to that trial that they agree to this particular trial. So that if the defendant says, no, we're not going to do multi-plaintiff trials, they can't happen. And so I think that, you know, if that takes root, some of the concerns that are manifest in Fakala have sort of been taken care of with it in the process. But I would just note, and I think this comes to an issue, too, that Chris and Jonathan may have some thoughts on as well, and that is, if we have a process going forward where, yes, you can have bellwether trials, but the court is sort of not involved in saying this is the case we're going to do, and the parties actually have to agree on either the cases or the details of the process, will that still work? I will just briefly say, I think it actually may work better, because I do think the parties in some instances can agree on trials. We've had cases where that's come up and we both said, yeah, that would be a good bellwether. And it may mean that those cases are more meaningful, because I think a lot of the problem with the bellwether process now is everyone talks about, well, that was a plaintiff pick, so that doesn't mean anything, or that was a defense pick, that doesn't mean anything. And frankly, both of us pick from both ends of the spectrum. You know, the defendant is looking for a case in which the plaintiff is in prison at the moment. And, you know, I mean, I'm just exaggerating, but I mean, that is how it works. But I do think we may be moving now toward a place where the bellwether process, if you decide to have one in a particular case, is something that the parties need to agree upon.
Well, thanks, John. Chris?
So I guess I started thinking about this by saying, thinking about the bellwether process and bellwether trials by saying, what else is there? You know, I don't think any of us have come up with an alternative to it, so I figured I'd just give my observations on what we have. In Tim Pratt's comments, he talked about there may be other ways than doing bellwether trials. I agree. I think that's something that should be explored. And I say that because my partner, Dave Buchanan, and I have probably been involved in trying ourselves over two dozen what people would consider bellwether trials over the years. We've done a number of them. And I'm not always convinced that they generate the information or the results that we think they do. But I will say some positive things about it is, I think the process is very useful. I mean, David Burnick made the comment earlier about identifying cross-cutting issues, and although we may disagree on what those issues are, that will hopefully come out of a well-designed bellwether process where you have, you know, cross-cutting issues. You get evidentiary rulings before trial, which are obviously very helpful, and I think that does inform the parties. It tells them something about the case, okay? Obviously, if the bellwether process results in a Daubert ruling that is helpful to the defendant, that cuts one way. If it's helpful to the plaintiff, it cuts another way. If it's cut down the middle, well, you have to digest that information and figure out what to make of it. But the process of going through that, briefing it, and thinking about it, I think, is a very useful part in coming to grips with what the case is really about, and ultimately what the value of the case may be if there is a time where the parties sit down and say, how do we get rid of this? I think I'll tell you one thing that you may not be aware of, and I think you probably are. Most of you are defense lawyers. You know, that process is very useful for the plaintiffs as well, because we you know, just like I think your side does sometimes, we drink our own Kool-Aid. We start to think every case looks good. And it's really helpful to finally have to dig into that and see, you know, the warts on the cases. The trials themselves, I'm a little less optimistic of, because I think that we're trial people. That's what we do. We're litigators. We try cases. So I think you fall into that rut of thinking that is the only way to resolve cases. The problem with trials is that we don't see a defense win as a total loss. And I can get into why. And by the way, you know, I don't think you guys see $100 or $200 million punitive damage verdict in any one case as a total loss. I think you have your way of looking at it. And I think we all know that the reality of what the cases are going to ultimately settle for is going to be probably more than zero and less than $200 million a case. So that's the part I don't know how valuable it is. But I will say this, and I think I come at this more from my Vioxx experience, John, where there were a number of cases tried. We did start to see, and I think they were helpful in Vioxx, we started to see a few things. One is, I think it helped both sides get their arms around the size of the litigation. We did notice that juries, you know, in the plaintiffs win, and they won more than we did in Vioxx, but in the plaintiffs wins, we started to notice that the cases that did better were before the first label change. They were doing better in the post-label change cases. That's very useful information if half the cases are pre-label and half the cases are post-label. So it does provide you with useful information, but I don't know if the number or the actual verdict does that. And do we need them, I guess, is another question I ask myself. I don't know any other way to get to I hope that doesn't come off like typical plaintiff's lawyer-ish when I say all these cases are going to eventually settle. They may settle for next to nothing, or they may settle for a lot. But I think I have this right, and if I'm wrong, I would love to hear from somebody on this, why I'm not looking at this right. But you know, all cases are going to settle at some point. They don't go away for zero, and they don't all go away for billions of dollars. So they're going to go away for somewhere in that range. And I don't know any other way to get us to the point where those discussions can occur other than this bellwether process and trials. Now, I think that we ought to get smart and put our heads together and try to figure another way. And that does come from a comment that was made to me by somebody at a pharmaceutical company one time in a social setting where we were actually talking about the Vioxx settlement. It was said publicly, so I don't think I'm speaking out of school, but that was a $4.85 billion settlement. But when you look at the transaction costs, what was spent on the defense side and what came out of the plaintiff side, when you include the fact that most plaintiff's lawyers were being paid pursuant to a one-third retainer. So let's say one-third of that went to attorney's fees. You know, do you need to really burn those kinds of transaction costs to get to that kind of result? So, you know, those are questions I think that have to be examined. That's why I think it is good, although we're here to talk about the bellwether process and how they drive settlements, I think it is important for parties to begin to explore the idea, at least, of settlement early on, even if it's not the kind of thing you want to do publicly. I've found in a handful of cases, even though the discussions took a year or more, or 2 years, and other things were going on, like trials and discovery, I think creating the trust that you need ultimately in each other and when you're negotiating a settlement, and the confidence that representations being made can be relied upon, that you have a reasonable person on the other side, I think that process takes time. So, you know, to the extent we're talking about how bellwethers or trials drive settlements, I think those are two things that can go hand in hand. I think they should go hand in hand, but you know, until somebody comes up with a better process, I can't think of one. So I tend to be a fan of the process right now and trials. The other thing I think too is that judges who also like us only know of one way to resolve cases. They either dismiss them or try them, are very comfortable with this process and tend to fall into this very easily because they think that's the way I get rid of cases. I set them for trial. And that's a little bit different in the MDL context because there are so many thousands. Just setting a few for trial may not do it. So, but anyway, those are my views.
Yep. And Brian, you're up next.
Well, I'm just happy to hear from the members of this panel, at least, that there is still a role for the trial. I was a little bit disheartened earlier when Professor Fitzpatrick said, quote, trial is failure. I think that's exactly what he said. And I thought, my God, I need to hurry up and save more money to retire because there's not much future in it. I want to say a few things. Assuming we agree that bellwether trials are appropriate and lawful, which John's raised an interesting question, and I've heard it from other people more recently, questioning whether this is something these courts should be doing at all. But assuming they do engage in a bellwether trial process, what about the mechanics of selecting those cases? And that, I think, is very can be very problematic because essentially what we're trying to do, I think we would all agree, is we want to pick cases which are somehow representative of the larger group of cases. And, of course, there's various methods I've seen courts use to try and come up with what are supposedly a representative sampling of cases. And all of those methods have some limitations, I think we would all agree. And, you know, most commonly you see a situation the court may say to both sides, you pick five plaintiffs, you pick five defendants, and the court will in some fashion choose which of those will go first or will do it in a sequential order, however the court comes up with it. But that process, of course, can be and is gamed, if you will, by the advocates. I mean, all the lawyers are advocates. They're not pushing to get a representative case. They want an unrepresentative case. They want a case that is a very strong plaintiff's case or a very strong defense case. And the courts have had varying success in policing that whole process of selecting bellwethers. And we've ended up with situations where, as was mentioned earlier, plaintiffs' bellwethers that are bad for plaintiffs get dismissed on the eve of trial. Defense cases can be settled on the eve of trial. So you have that process really hasn't, in my view, produced representative cases the way we would hope it would if it's going to be helpful to us in valuing the whole inventory. That is one problem. And I think a larger problem, though, is how do you know what's representative when you don't know much about 90% of the cases? I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about this morning. You can go 2 years in an MDL, and by the end of 2 years, you will know everything you ever wanted to know about the corporate defendant and its alleged malfeasance. You will have seen, you know, hundreds of hours of deposition testimony. Every embarrassing email will have been explored and explored again. But you may know absolutely nothing or very, very little of substance about this amorphous mass of people out there who are the plaintiffs in the case who've sued for damages. So how, given that reality in many MDLs, how do we then make intelligent decisions about what a representative case will be? So that's why I think this sort of looping back to our discussions earlier, I think working with people like Chris who are willing to think outside the box and who understand the dimensions of this problem, I think the defense and plaintiffs can learn to work together to get better information about cases earlier on so that we can then make more intelligent decisions about the bellwether process. But those are some of the issues that I think are prevalent in this area.
Okay. And if you would go up next for us, Jonathan, that'd be great.
Sure. So I'm going to talk about it from a little bit of a different perspective because I don't do individual or mass tort MDLs. I do class cases. And more of those are in MDLs in recent years. And I've been involved in three class action trials, which is a fairly large number, I think. It's somewhat of a rare beast. One, the Whirlpool Washer trial, where, for lack of a better word, I was sort of the ringmaster on our side. I was lead trial counsel in one, and back in the 90s, I served as sort of the backroom associate doing all the brief writing in one. So I've seen them from a number of different perspectives. And to the extent I learned anything from those of use, and I think that's an open question, I sort of break it into two categories, one of which I'll call big picture or process type lessons, and then the second is more sort of granular practice type lessons. And bellwethers, which is really the focus of our conversation, falls into the former, which is the big picture lessons. And really the first thing that I've taken away from this experience is that class action trials are a thing, and they can be done. And they do not need to be and aren't necessarily more complicated or difficult than any other trial that judges and lawyers are used to doing, at least any other complex trial. So there's obviously some different issues at play, but there are ways in which it is just like any other trial. And there are ways to simplify it that I think both parties ought to be able to agree on. And that includes things like bellwether trials. And so I want to talk a little bit about the bellwether concept in the class context. If the goal is to make the case as complicated as possible at every stage, as John Beisner, for example, is very good at doing, so that it can't be certified or it must be decertified or needs to be reversed, certification needs to be reversed on appeal, a defendant can certainly make that the focus of the case and not work together with plaintiff's counsel in the court to try to streamline issues and make good use of things like the bellwether process. But it can be done. So just by way of example, in the Whirlpool litigation, after we filed, I think, 27 motions for class certification because we had to do state by state by state in the Sixth Circuit, the parties sat down and looked at each other and said, are we really going to make this court wade through 27 motions for class certification, 27 summary judgment motions, 27 Daubert motions, on and on and on? And we ultimately agreed that that didn't make a lot of sense. And so while that was as hotly contested a litigation in many respects as you will ever see, we were able to sit down and agree that it made sense to pick a single state to go first essentially on everything. And so we picked Ohio because that's where the MDL court sat. The parties agreed to try the Ohio case under Ohio law, recognizing that Ohio had some unusual claims that weren't necessarily element by element the same as claims in other states. It wasn't representative in that sense, but it was going to give us the ability to see what the court thought about class certification, to see what the court thought about Daubert and summary judgment, and frankly, to see how the story would come in at the end of the day. And that's one of the other lessons I think that I've taken away, is that class trials, bellwether trials, are valuable. Not necessarily because of the results obtained. It doesn't necessarily matter who wins at the end of the day, unless it's a bet the company try everything case, which, as I understand it, folks on the other side don't like to do. If we can take one state so that it's not a bet the company trial that's going on, both sides can learn an awful lot about very mundane things. I was talking with Professor Fitzpatrick before the panel today, and one of the things that we took away, for example, from the Whirlpool case, and it was true in the other class cases that I tried, the evidence that we thought was the most compelling and the most powerful, the stories we thought were really going to resonate, didn't. Some of the things we thought were much weaker did. I am fairly confident the other side came to the same kinds of conclusions about that, and it very much influenced how we then went forward in that case in planning for the subsequent bellwether trials, and ultimately in resolving the case, which we were able to do. And Chris made the point about plaintiffs sometimes believing their own, I'll use a different word, their own bullshit, in a case. And it helped us realize that maybe our case wasn't as open and shut as we thought it was. And so it enabled us to reach a reasonable settlement in that case. So I guess that's sort of the big picture process lesson that I take, is that I think that bellwethers can be useful, particularly in the class context, particularly if you use them to select one state. And by bellwether, I mean not just trying it, but the pretrial as well. Seeing what the judge thinks about certifying a single state class, seeing what that judge thinks about summary judgment in Daubert under that state's laws and on those expert reports in that context can be very, very valuable. There are issues about agreeing on which state should go first. We went with Ohio. It addressed lexicon issues there. I'm involved in another case now where we're proposing the same thing, that we try the claims of the state where the court is sitting, both because the court is familiar with that law, and because it solves lexicon type issues. Then there's just one more sort of comment I wanted to make on the more granular practice level, and I think this sort of connects to the other lesson to some degree, which is that one of the things I've taken away from trying some class cases is that the same things matter. The plaintiff's claims matter. Who your class representatives from our perspective are matter. The depositions that you took matter. The way the claims are pled matter. The cases that I was involved with earlier in my career taught me that I need to be thinking about a class case going to trial from the moment that case comes into my office, which is not something I necessarily knew before, because people said, oh, well, class cases never go to trial. You're never going to have to worry about it. And the lesson I learned is I better be worried about it. And from the defense perspective, you should too, because they really do go to trial. Yeah. So those are my thoughts.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Jonathan. Let me exercise moderator prerogative and toss out the first question for the group before we get your reactions to each of your own presentations, which is this. How did we get here to where we are with these bellwether trials when we're dealing with an MDL process that by definition is supposed to be about pretrial proceedings? Is it, and I've heard a number of kind of hints of suggestions of what you think about that, is it because there's no other way to do it? Is it because trials are the institutional competence of the trial judges? Is it because there was a follow the leader kind of concept where some early ones, you know, pioneered the bellwether trials and then other judges said, what the heck, let's give that a trial, give that a try, and then it snowballs? What are each of your reactions to, you know, how it is we've gotten to the place we're at now?
Yeah, I think it's really what I was touching on earlier, and that is that, as the prior panel noted, I think there is somewhat of a culture that exists among, well, within the system generally, but also for the judges to whom MDL proceedings are assigned, that we should be moving towards some sort of resolution, towards settlement. And as I suggested earlier, you sit there and you say, well, what can you do to educate yourself about that? And this notion of a bellwether trial, I think, is the most obvious solution. I think, though, one of the issues is that, as I've heard several people mention this morning, there's just so much in these MDL proceedings that are just ad hoc rules that have been made up for the occasion. You know, we just sort of have this playbook that really isn't on the shelf, but we all pull down. And, you know, having had occasion to be before an appellate court recently, you know, the subject, for example, of direct filing orders came up.
You're like,
and the panel's going, what the hell is that? Where's the authority? Where's that in the statute?
Yeah.
What, you can sort a way of personal jurisdiction so the court can deal with these, but not, I mean, and there's just so much we do. And lexicon itself, to go to the heart of your question, I don't think that when that case went to the Supreme Court, you'd have found many regular MDL practitioners who would have said, oh, yeah, the court's going to flip that. You know, unanimous ruling saying, where the hell did you get authority to do that? And so it came, like so many things in MDL proceedings, in sort of an ad hoc process, often that are proposed by plaintiffs and defendants together. I'm not saying these are
part of the culture.
They're all part of things that the judiciary came up with. But I think it was just somewhat out of desperation to say, okay, court wants these settled, pressing us to settle these. How do we get information to do this? I think that's where it came from.
Yeah. Chris? I don't disagree with John. I think he's right. You know, I just think over the years of, I don't know when the MDL panel started their judges school where they go, I believe it's in West Palm Beach once a year, and I don't know when that occurred, but my guess is it's been going on for the past 15 years, because I think that's when a lot of these conventions begun to be built into the process. You know, where judges started working off a similar type playbook, if not, you know, a playbook. I don't think there's any real playbook. I know there are guidelines that are sent out. There are suggestions. I know Duke published best practices. That's only in the last few years. But they all started to do similar things, which means that as an institution, they were sharing information and experiences with each other. So I think this all grew up probably as a result of what John and David and others say, the lack of rules that dictate what to do, and more in an effort to create solutions to some novel and really big problems. Again, you know, I think we disagree as to whether that's a good or a bad thing. I don't see a problem with that because in my entire career, whether it's been a mass tort case, a class action case, or a really big, hairy, complicated single incident case, you know, lawyers have gotten together to solve problems that aren't necessarily smack dab in the rules, working with the courts to do that, and I think we do that here. So I guess, and I've said this a few times today, I'm not sure I fully grasp or understand the discomfort with that. You know, maybe I need to spend a little more time talking to friends of mine on the other side and trying to get an understanding of it, but I think John nailed it. I just think it grew up with these cases. It just is one of the things we follow now. Although most judges, I'm sorry, I will tell you, lately judges have said, and we've seen this in our cases, give me your proposal. If you want to do something different, give me a proposal that works. Now, are they ready to make that jump? I don't know, because if they have the perception that a bellwether process, the selection of bellwether cases and the process and the trials went successfully five times before them, they're not likely to break from that. But I know in the case that David and I have, I thought that with the court's input and us, you know, slugging it out, we came up with a decent process for selecting bellwether cases that included a number of ideas that were floating around. Randomization, not exactly what you wanted, not exactly what I wanted, with lawyers' involvement in selecting cases and working up some minimal discovery, and then the court ultimately selecting cases for trial. I actually like that process. I think it's one that, you know, people should look at going forward.
Random, you think?
It was a pure random selection of 100 cases from like a pool of 600. And then each side, we selected 16 each, if I remember. We worked them up, some really basic discovery, and then made proposals to the court on a pool of 8 cases to be tried. And they all had to be trial ready at the same time. This is one thing I probably would never want to do again. It was just, you know, working, having 8 cases ready so that if one goes away, the next one slots in was a nightmare. But that process really, as much as I hated the concept of randomization, and I'm sure David hated some aspects of what he, you know, ultimately wound up having to do, kind of worked, I thought. About as good as...
To follow up on that point, without digressing too much off the question, I do believe randomized selection processes are probably the best way to go to select bellwethers.
It wasn't pure random,
right.
But yeah.
Some version of randomization I've come to believe personally is more, ultimately leads to a better outcome than the processes where we advocate for different cases on the plaintiff and defense sides. But
which now you know why when I say to you we don't want these guys filing their crappy cases in the MDL, I mean it. Because we're going to get stuck trying, you know, they're not going to try them. I mean, to keep cutting you off. But
no, that's exactly right. I mean, that's why we as defendants, I love a randomization. If I think 90% or even 30 or 40% of the cases are not merit-worthy, then the randomized process has a lot better chance of catching those. As to where all this came from, I mean, I guess, you know, there have been influential figures in the judiciary. Certainly Judge Fallon wrote a very important article on bellwether trials that I think has been very persuasive to a lot of people, influential. But I don't think it's something that the judiciary has foisted on the parties. I mean, I think both defense and plaintiffs have sort of bought into this concept for a number of years that this is the outcome or is one stage in the process that we're all engaged in. So I think now we're reevaluating our commitment to that process because we've seen that it's not really working the way we would hope it to work in all cases. So, but I do think it's something that the parties have come to. And I think one of the reasons they've come to it is because there's a lot of pressure from the judges that remand is failure. I mean, remand is viewed as failure by the judges. I think they're teaching that in judges' school, or at least that's my guess, because the judges want the cases to be settled while they're still in the MDL, and I think the bellwether process is viewed as a way to get to that result. And so I think that's where some of the judicial pressure is coming from, is as an effort to precipitate a global settlement of the cases before they have to be sent back.
Jonathan? Yeah, I guess I would... I don't have any grand insight into the origins of this, but to me, it strikes me that it comes from two sort of driving forces that are somewhat in tension. One is the hunger for information about how good your case is on both sides, right? Joined with the competing problem of risk aversion. You don't really want to risk everything. And so if you can do bellwethers and get some information without betting everything on both sides, I think that's sort of human nature that you would try to to play that game. And I think that's, to me at least, that's what I think where it comes from.
Okay. So any reactions to the opening presentations any of you made? Any violent disagreements on the panelists with any of the points one of their fellows made?
I didn't, but I do have a question that I would love to get a defense perspective on this, because the issue, and Jonathan just brought up the issue of, it might have been Brian on remanding, but somebody had mentioned that. So my question is, and I'm really curious about this, let's assume the bellwether process doesn't result in what the judge wants it to result in, and maybe even the parties mildly would like to come out of that with a settlement they both could live with. But let's assume you can't get there, and the cases are remanded. I mean, doesn't that strategically really create an issue for you for when the day comes that you say, hey, we're ready to scoop these up, settle them, and pay some money, and get rid of the litigation? You're now in district courts throughout the country. You've kind of lost the ability of the MDL judge to sort of help shepherd the settlement and then help you close it down. Because let's be honest, judges have become more active in the settlement process to the point where, because we don't use Rule 23 to settle a lot of these mass tort cases. I mean, the NFL was an exception, and I don't know if it's going to grow into other things. So let's assume Rule 23 is not available. The judges have been very involved in endgame orders that really do help shut down the litigation. They make rulings on statute of limitations at the end. They will issue lone pine orders at the end of the litigation under the theory that you've been around for years, and if you haven't worked up your case and know something about it now, well, you've got 90 days to do it. And then they issue orders on accelerated discovery. And, you know, I think they have been tremendously successful in ending, in cutting off the tail that typically comes when you settle, when a defendant settles the case. So my question is, and John, if you've given some thought to this, Brian, like, what happens if the case gets scattered, all the cases are scattered to the wind, and then you want to settle it?
Chris, I think there's two aspects of that. I think there are some MDL proceedings that I've been in where you feel that you conclude that plaintiff's counsel really don't have much interest in trying most of these cases. There are cases, and in the MDL proceeding, if the court has been, you know, not found its way to grant summary judgment motions to sort of grapple with some of these issues. And so you sort of have cases there that have survived whatever process you've gone through, but are weak. I think increasingly you're going to see defendants say, let's just take these back, because when they hit the courtroom in, you know, the Northern District of wherever, the judge is going to look at this and start saying, let's do discovery on this plaintiff, and counsel are going to conclude this ain't worth it. Right. You know, this was a proceeding that existed because of the mass nature of it, not because of the merits of the individual claims. Or you may conclude, you know, there are a couple of cases there that would be create jury sympathy that you'd worry about, but you can pick those off, sure, and you don't do the global settlement. And if the court isn't going to provide some assistance in getting to that conclusion, just let it all go. So I think increasingly you're going to see that happening. I've been in some where, and indeed, if you call a bluff, I've been in at least one where, when we said that, it just quietly disappeared. And I think there are others like that as well. So it's a case-specific analysis.
One size fits all.
I do think that would happen. On the other hand, you know, I think your point is well taken. I think that a couple of you were at a meeting yesterday where I mentioned this story, so forgive me for telling it again, but I some years ago, before an MDL argument that ended up on with a lot of visibility, I was asked by a USA Today reporter, you know, what is an MDL proceeding? And I gave a lawyerly answer, and the reporter's like, well, I can't use that. And so I finally said, this is all to prevent the movie Groundhog Day occurring for lawyers, that you're going to a different court every day of the week and doing the same thing over and over again, likely with the same result. And that really is, you know, that is an issue for defendants. You know, if you get stuck with 8 trials at the same time and you're trying to provide employee witnesses for that, you can't do it, you know. So you do have to weigh those things. But I do think there are some where increasingly when the court says, well, we're just going to have to remand this, you may get more responses just saying, be my guest.
Do it. Yeah.
I do think defendants generally can withstand the remand process more than plaintiffs. I mean, the resource issues become a bigger problem, I think, for the plaintiff side of the equation than for the defendants if you get into a mass remand situation. But I think John's absolutely right. It all depends on the quality of the underlying cases. I mean, if it's a good, solid inventory of plaintiff's cases, then the likelihood of defendants wanting to remand and try them all over the country is much less than if they're cases that we think are going to evaporate if they're exposed to the light of day.
Gotcha.
So, well, let me take this opportunity then to see if we have any questions from the audience. Anyone who has any questions for our four panelists?
A suggestion, Chris. I really think that if you were to kind of walk through the steps of what happened in testosterone on randomization and cross-cutting issues,
it may be useful for the group because an awful lot of time was spent on that. We both got things that we wanted, and it goes to the whole issue of selection as well as cross pretrial proceedings. If you want to.
Yeah, just tell me if I get it wrong. Cause it's been a while. I mean, you know, something happened last week and I can't remember it. So, look, there was a lot of negotiating over this. Both sides were making their arguments to the court, and I think the court, kind of forced us to meld our ideas. David was a proponent of the randomization idea, but it was a little different than what we actually did. David wanted to create categories and randomize within those categories. Is that fair?
You keep on running the randomizer.
Yeah.
Until you get categories for each cross
cutting
issue.
Yeah, and he even had a great statistician help him with Laurentius Murray. Bane of my existence.
I know that guy.
When is he going to go away, David?
This was part of a process where, as Chris mentioned, we didn't go after the medical. We just used the plain fact sheets. Yeah. On the theory that they were pretty granular and they were good enough so that we could figure out for anybody who came out of the randomization process what their story was without having to wait 3 years to go through medical records. So the judge established a deadline for the completion of plaintiff fact sheets for the most of the pool. We then did randomization.
Cut it off. We said it, yeah.
We then did randomization to pick 100. And within the 100, we then both did selections and the judge arbitrated on, quote, outliers and also whether we were covering the cross-cutting issues.
Yeah. I went into it kicking and screaming. I think in some aspects you weren't thrilled, but I thought it worked out pretty well.
I think it did work out.
And, people should look at that. I mean, there's an order, I think. Well, it probably doesn't give you all the background we just went into, but the order which lays out the process, it was a pretty pretty good. And, it kind of melded together sort of, the Judge Fallon approach, which is the party's pick, and then the court with randomization, which I believe is in the manual for complex litigation. And, Duke had their own approach to it, and we built all of those into this process, but it was... And what did we get stuck with? We got stuck with cases that neither one of us, if we were talking honestly, would say we'd loved. We don't love them, you don't love them, so, perfect for trial.
One thing I just wanted to note, sort of going back to some of the earlier discussions, but that links up to this, the prior panel, there's a lot of discussion about getting information about individual cases and that sort of thing. And one thing I wanted to add to that is I think that what often gets overlooked by parties in courts that say, we don't want to invest time in this, is that you pay a price for that later in the case if you don't do it in other respects. One is bellwether selection. If you don't have an idea of what that pool is, what kinds of cases are out there, what issues, differentiated issues may be presented by different cases and so on, you really could end up with bellwether trials that tell you something about that case, but it's not replicated anywhere else in the inventory. The other part of it I would say, too, is I think often courts that resist that are short-sighted when it comes to the settlement process, because I've been in cases where the court said, we don't want to waste time with that, and then decide someday we need to get this case settled in 60 days, and they send everybody off to go talk to people, and you know, some people you sit down with, you talk to Chris, and basically it's like being in a car dealership because he's got this long list of information about every claim. He's got a suggested retail price, but what you'll give it to me
I've
for.
Heard the Chinese menu. I've heard the Chinese menu comparison, but the car dealership.
Yeah, so,
I don't know where that was going.
Have that. And then you go to somebody else, and they don't know how many cars they have and or anything about them. And you just go, what? And they say, well, you know, I got a number. And I say, fine, but I want to know what I'm buying here. And it takes months because they have not themselves done any investigation of the claim to know what it is. And you know, maybe they'll eventually come up with a number. But I think it's just not, the question was raised, you know, why don't you just not worry about this? There's a lot of reasons that are of interest to both sides. Why, and, you know, knowing the inventory, winnowing claims that shouldn't be there is critical.
Yeah, and the one thing I would just add to the discussion David Burnick and I were just having is we didn't know, you know, there were a pool of about 600. We picked 100. You looked at fact sheets at that level. The next level was 32 cases, and we did core discovery, which included like four depositions, and we had caps on what you would get in ordering full-blown medical records at that point. And then from those 32, each side picked, I forget, what did we get, six or eight? Eight. And the court picked eight for trial, right? Isn't that what you, yeah. So you could see that it was kind of like a funnel, and as we got toward the end, we knew everything about the cases there, so.
Was there any penalty for dismissal of cases or settlement of cases?
There wasn't. First of all, there were still problems with the plaintiff's factions being complete. Those, you just have to kind of say, okay. With respect to dismissals, though, the judge has been very firm about that.
He's trying to give you a microphone.
Yeah,
the judge has been very firm about that. So basically the idea was, once these things are picked, you're not going to dismiss them. They're going to be dismissed with prejudice. And then now that it's kind of come around again, where he gets any kind of sense that people are using, like, lexicon waivers as a way of kind of selecting or not selecting cases, he has been extremely diligent in making sure that that doesn't happen. So that the cases that are bellwether cases, unless they're dismissed by him, they're going. And he's been pretty good about it. I mean, he's been excellent about it, really.
Absolutely.
I think that's one of the benefits of having a bellwether selection process that does have a random dimension to it, if not being outright random, because you learn an awful lot about the inventory and what counsel, plaintiff's counsel, genuinely believe about their cases. I was in one MDL proceeding where we went through trial selection, and you know, a case would be selected, and then you'd get this panicked, oh, we don't want to do that case. And this was happening repeatedly, and the court kept pressing on and started giving warnings about taking cases to trial. So counsel weren't dismissing them at that point. And then we had two trials in a row where it emerged. And it does happen, as Judge Rubino was raising earlier, the cases were fraudulent. And I'm not sure counsel knew they were, but in one case, a person who claimed to be totally disabled, we got a videotape, not that we asked for, wow, from a neighbor who had...
The neighbor sent it to you.
Neighbor sent it to us because a guy had been bragging about how much money he was going to get of this guy spending day chopping wood in the yard, mowing, and all this stuff. And the next one of our associates just happened to check the next plaintiff out of his Facebook page and, again, claimed to be totally disabled. And he had won a speedboat race the weekend before trial, and he was there holding the trophy. And, you know, I mean, so... And so then plaintiffs were sort of put in the position of pushing these cases to trial that they probably shouldn't have. So at that point, the court said, I need a certification of trial readiness, and there's going to be a penalty if you don't go forward. Suddenly, the inventory just shrank dramatically because of that. So again, you know, it's that selection process had other purposes than just we can get a trial. It's a way to really test the quality of the inventory, provided there's some randomness to it, and it's just not a both sides are going to nominate.
I have a real quick funny story about this process I went through many years ago. involving a drug called Reslin. Do you guys remember that? Reslin litigation. I was in court. The defense lawyer was on the other side. And he was complaining to the court about how crappy the cases were. And I'm going to tell you the story after telling you we did such a good job screening. And he's like, yeah, Judge, we got one guy who has a, you know, it was liver failure was the injury. We got one guy who's got a bullet in his liver. And I'm like, who the hell would file a case like that? He's like, you. It turned out what he left out was that our guy was a Korean War vet, and he was shot in like 1951, and he survived the bullet. But, you know, some funny things. And I'm just trying to add levity to that.
Can I ask a question that kind of follows up on these last couple of comments? And that is, we put so much reliance on these fact sheets. Are these under oath? Are they accurate? Does anyone go and like verify whether the fact sheet matches reality? Are there any experiences you've had where they didn't match reality? Are there penalties for not matching reality, et cetera?
Oh, I've had a number of depositions in cases where you put the fact sheet in front of the witness. And so have you seen this before? No. And there's no familiarity with it, and they run away from it. I mean, in most proceedings I've been in, it does say this is the same as an interrogatory answer, and they're required to sign it and so on. But you also, in a lot of the cases, see that the answers to all the questions are the same for everybody who is represented by X, except for birth date and... Well, you know, I was going to say a name, but that gets screwed up sometimes.
Social Security numbers.
I think the really critical thing is to gain access to medical records. And again, I'm not talking about a requirement that you produce, you know, the life history of any particular person. But I'm thinking that if you're, and again, I'm speaking about cases where medical records are relevant, but I think that's most of the mass tort cases we're talking about. You'd think that somewhere along the line, counsel would check just to make sure, as somebody said earlier, that there's something out there that says they took X or had this implant or whatever, so you can confirm that, and that they had, so that they had the exposure to the risk that's being alleged in the case. And that they experience some consequence, that whatever side effect or whatever is alleged is documented in some way. And that tells you an enormous amount because, you know, in the latter, some alternative causes may be suggested and so on. You really get a sense of the pattern. But I think the medical records, those contemporaneous records, are probably the most critical part of that. But you don't see that required in a lot of MDLs, and the courts sometimes resist or counsel resist just because it's thought to be.
John, is tell us to get a here's an authorization, and you can go and get it yourself. And we've got to remember the scale of these cases and the cost associated with collecting medical records of even 1,000 plaintiffs can be millions and millions of dollars. It's a not trivial expense. Even in tens of millions of dollars in cases in which I've been involved have been spent on obtaining medical records over the course of the litigation. So that is one problem we have in these. I see in a lot of MDLs is the refusal to require the plaintiffs to come forward, not with lone pine, not with full expert reports, not with affidavits, but just with some basic information about the cases that we don't have to go and ferret out at our considerable expense. I mean, I think that is a very reasonable requirement. And I think Chris would even agree on that.
We're doing it now. In the cases I've recently gotten involved, I mentioned this, a pharmacy record and a proof of income, which is pretty basic.
Right.
David?
I mean, I think there are two dimensions of the fact sheet that are at issue. One is the verification really does matter. And they do say, I swear it's true. And if the client signs that, which is pretty much required, it really does become useful at trial if it's gone all over the place. And actually, in Chris and I's litigation, but in state court, the plaintiffs there had their multiple errors in the plaintiff fact sheet to the point that even at the time of trial, it was not accurate. So it really does have consequences. But two, in the context of the overall litigation dynamics, if you don't have that fact sheet, and it's not detailed, it makes it much more difficult to conduct discovery. And fact sheets actually, I think, go back to the implant litigation. Sam Pointer required them for every single plaintiff. And they were 20 pages long. And the idea is that you really make the plaintiff do the work that's necessary and saves everybody a lot of time. So it's a pretty useful tool. And when it's not accurate, which it often is not, it's a problem.
So here's a question, you know, bouncing off of that, which is there's a lot of consensus among you. Why isn't there, you know, given something like that, a section of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure about these kinds of issues? Why isn't there a specific Federal Rule of Civil Procedure about fact sheets or short-form joiners?
Because it's, you know, there is a federal rule. It's called Rule 34.
Yeah. Yeah.
And interrogatories, this is effectively a form interrogatory.
That's right.
But why isn't it targeted to MDLs? Wouldn't
It's because the rules historically have not been that targeted to a particular type of litigation. And I think that, you know, again, I in approaching these things and in addressing the courts on these issues, think that from a defendant's perspective, we ought to be looking more at the rules as being in effect in these cases and say to the court, look, if you let the plaintiffs do Rule 34 discovery, why don't we get it with respect to each plaintiff? We don't want it necessarily in all cases.
Right.
But that when it comes to the fact sheet, you know, give us a break on that because we're not allowed to file Rule 12 motions as you normally would be permitted to do. We can't request admissions. We can't ask interrogatories. We can't do anything under the rules. But in the MDL proceeding, meanwhile, plaintiffs get full use of all those rules with respect to the defendant. And, you know, so... You know, I won't say it's necessarily of due process proportions, but it is a very one-sided approach to the use of the rules. And so I think you use that to say to the court, you got to give us at least some of this stuff, because otherwise all of these things that are in the rules in part to ensure that claims are investigated before these files are not there.
See, this is
that's why I think that may be more the approach that we're taking. I have some fear that if you had separate rules for MDLs, it may simply reaffirm that the district courts have very broad discretion and can basically do whatever they want. And I think that takes us in the wrong direction on that. That's what I worry about. That I think we're in a better position to say these rules apply. We understand, you know, we may not want to be taking the deposition of every plaintiff in the case. We probably don't, but we need to get some surrogates for that in return.
But the one thing about the practice that we live in and that we've helped develop is that for every convention that's been created, it's been created to resolve a problem. So the fact sheets were there because it just didn't make sense to do, you know, to serve interrogatories and document production requests against every plaintiff. It just didn't make any sense to do it. In fact, the fact sheet streamlined it, hopefully gave the defendants what they wanted, maybe not everything they'd get in a document production request or interrogatories, but gave them enough so they can go take a deposition. Maybe somewhere along the line, I don't know, something got screwed up in there. You know, well, I can tell you one thing I could not take responsibility for, but that I've observed myself is, you know, you've got a lot of firms that come into doing this kind of work who do nothing but advertise. They just raise money and advertise and park cases, and they don't do a good job on fact sheets. So it's a problem I think both sides have to deal with in some respects on that. But, you know, also on the defense side, though, we typically would, you know, if we didn't have defendant fact sheets, which are fact sheets that give us information about sales reps that detail doctors and things that are said in that context, and call notes if they exist, and if call notes don't exist, something else, we would have to get that discovery in some other way that would be probably truly burdensome for the defendant. So each one of these little conventions and inventions that we've come up with is to solve what we, I think, all perceive to be a bigger problem.
So this
doesn't mean
we
can't do a better job, though. You
know? This is our last question. We have 2 minutes left, Doug.
Oh, I didn't mean to monopolize the last question.
But following up, I sat quietly the whole time.
Following up on Chris's comment, I mean, why don't defendants in some of these MDLs just call the plaintiff's bluff and say, fine, remand it, we'll try cases, and we'll try them against the people that just sit there advertising the claims? You know, I've had cases in state court where, that were not thousands of cases, but 100. And the judge says, we're just going to try one after the other. And the plaintiff's lawyers weren't very good poker players. And I think they would have paid us to get rid of the cases. There's no way they wanted to do that. So maybe if some defendants did that, maybe it would change some things.
You know, if we didn't get stuck with those early, you know, I would have been more than happy to let Burnick trash those guys, kill them at trade, like he's doing in state court up there, just stomping those guys into the ground. But I'd have to live with the consequences of their screw-ups, and then, you know, so I don't know. Maybe there's some other way. Maybe remand is the way to go. You go pick them off.
No. I think but I think you're seeing variations of this. I think this is why you will see many fewer Vioxx-type settlements where you try to say, we'll cover all these claims. You got a Gates requirement to make sure that you're
screen
not allowing
a
claim that screen out the junk that doesn't warrant compensation. But I think you'll see far fewer of those because in a lot of proceedings, you know, if you know Chris is ready, he's going to try cases and so on, you may want to, pardon the phrase, get rid of Chris.
Get rid of me anytime you want. Please. Happy to go.
And winnow the thing down so what you got left of these guys who have no idea where the courthouse is, let alone what they need to do when they get there.
That's true.
And say, what do you want to do now? I'm not saying that's literally happening in all MDL proceedings, but I think it's why you are seeing a migration back to more frequently using inventory settlements because of the perception that these claims are not worth the same amount, not necessarily because of the way you analyze the strength of a particular claim, but because how they came into being, what the source is, and who's handling the particular lawsuit.
So Laura, I'm correct that 1:45 is our end time. All right, well, we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thanks very much, and thanks to the audience.